It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin political scientist on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what Russia's goals may be at this point. First, it's Election Day in Wisconsin, and elections can often get people reflecting on how things are going in their lives at the state, local, national, and international levels. Are we prospering? If yes, do we reward the incumbents? If no, do we give someone else a chance? We don't have any state or nationwide races on the ballot today. There are a lot of domestic and global issues to reflect on. And our next guest is offering reasons for us to be positive about America's position in all of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How prosperous do you feel like the United States is in this moment? What does prosperity look like to you? Do you feel like the country is on a strong economic footing, its recovery from the early days of the pandemic? What threats do you see to American prosperity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Koplovich is a professor in the Political Science Department and the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He's director of European Studies at UW. He recently wrote in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about what he believes to be America's ongoing, enduring prosperity and strength, despite inflation, the war in Ukraine, and other problems. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again. It's nice to be back.
I want to talk about the why, first of all. You wrote this piece. You said a feeling of skepticism, pessimism out there in the American media and the public.
Yes. So, I wrote this mainly as a reaction to what I've been seeing in terms of the public and political debate about the state of the economy in the United States. We have just lived through a 2-year pandemic, which is unprecedented. But we've also had an unprecedentedly rapid and successful economic recovery. Right. So unemployment was nearly 15% in April of 2020. And by pretty much every metric in terms of jobs, income, consumption, investment, whatever economic activity you're talking about, we've had basically a full recovery economically since the onset of the pandemic, which is, by comparison to the global financial crisis, it took us over a decade and we never really fully recovered, or the Great Depression, which took years and years to recover from. That was sort of my reaction was, yes, inflation is high and inflation is higher than it's been in a very long time. But inflation is high around the world, right? The levels of U.S. inflation are roughly the levels of inflation that you're seeing in the European Union countries, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, et cetera. And so it just sort of seems to me there's a bit of a disconnect between how well the U.S. economy is actually doing and has recovered. And we've had a much better and faster recovery than the other countries I just mentioned. And the state of the political debate, which is, the U.S. economy is terrible. Right. Unemployment is incredibly low right now. Inflation certainly is eroding people's incomes now. But if you actually look at the data and factor in the money that most households received from stimulus checks and the child credits and all of the policies that were put into place by the U.S. government over the last year or so, real income and real consumption actually haven't gone down. Right. So it seems there's a sort of a disconnect between how much the public is suffering and how bad the economy is doing. And what the data suggest is the U.S. economy is actually doing well, very strong, both in absolute terms and relative to other countries that we might compare ourselves to.
In your piece, you refer to some surveys showing the American public worried about the economy. There's been some other survey data where Americans think unemployment has gone up in recent months and when it's gone down. I want to throw in a word here that might account for the discrepancy between the data you're pointing toward and how people feel. Uncertainty. All through COVID, it seems like there's always another shoe we're waiting for to drop. Do you think that may account for some of that difference?
Absolutely. Again, we're living through unprecedented times, and is uncertainty about the geopolitics and war, about the state of the economy, about the next wave of the coronavirus pandemic. I think that's what a lot of the public opinion surveys are picking up. I do also think that there's an aspect of framing and media cues and coverage. I think one of the things I mentioned in the op-ed is the the ratio, I've been tracking the amount of coverage about inflation relative to unemployment in the media for the last year or so. And it's something on the order on a month-to-month basis of about a 12-to-1 ratio of articles on inflation versus unemployment. Right. And actually, in the last couple of months, that ratio is more like 20-to-40-to-1. And so I think, you know, we saw this the last few weeks with gas prices, that people hear a lot about inflation is really high. It's a huge problem. Here's what's going on with gas prices. There's been relatively little coverage about, you know, the unemployment rate has fallen from the highest level it's been in 80 years to the lowest level it's been in 80 years in the last 10 months. Right. And, you know, I think that it's the combination of both of those things, and obviously politics as well. Right. You know, in any political system, the opposition party has lots of incentive to say that the economy is doing poorly and blame the incumbents for what's going on. And, you know, that's a feature of politics. It's not something that's specific to the United States. But I think some of that is what's going on as well.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison, he wrote a piece saying, hey, America, the United States is more prosperous than you might think it is. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our calls, Mark, one question is, okay, compared to what? And there's, I think, a concern that, okay, China is on the rise. Russia is this threat. We've got these rival countries representing different government systems. And there's a fear that somehow they're doing better than us, gaining on us, overtaking us in some way.
Right. And this is actually, you know, the what we've been talking about so far was kind of the short-term set of developments that I've been thinking about. But the other reason I wrote this piece is the longer-term developments and narratives. You know, the point is not to deny that there are serious problems in the United States, economic and politically, or that, you know, households and individuals aren't facing hard times because of inflation. But if you look at the problems of the U.S. relative to the challenges and difficulties that China and Russia face, we are unquestionably stronger, right? And the big thing I wrote about in the piece was on the monetary and financial side. You know, I study the economic side of international relations. And, you know, one of the things you've actually seen is that on display in the last several weeks with the Western sanctions led by the U.S. on Russia. Right? The U.S. global economy runs on dollars. Interest rates are unprecedentedly low. And the United States' ability both to borrow and invest and spend is, you know, much, much stronger than China's or Russia's. There are political questions about whether we will do that. And there's political debates about debt and deficits, but our ability to actually borrow and spend is unprecedented. And what we saw with the sanctions was, you know, in a very, very short amount of time, the U.S., along with our NATO allies and European Union allies, and the Canadians and the Japanese, were basically able to completely choke off Russia from the global economy because the world economy runs on dollars and euros. And the financial sanctions have basically targeted Russia. And Russia has the ruble, and the ruble is not a global reserve currency. China has the renminbi. The renminbi is becoming somewhat more important in the world economy, but 60% of foreign exchange reserves that governments hold are dollars. Another 25% are euros. 2% are Chinese renminbi, right? And so there's a, you know, I think a lot of the debate about China, because China is large and they're big in terms of international trade, is that they're sort of surpassing the U.S. But when you look at things both on the military side and even more so on the money and financial side, the gap between the U.S. and China is still very large. And the gap between the U.S. and China on the one hand and Russia on the other is enormous.
We're talking to Mark Koplovich, professor in the political science department at UW-Madison. He says, despite multiple challenges, American prosperity is going pretty well right now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree with what you're hearing from our guest? What questions do you have? What factors do you weigh when you weigh the American economy? Call 800-642-1234. We'll hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about American prosperity and global strength, including financial strength. Mark Koplovich stays with us, professor in the Political Science Department and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I work in the electrical industry. In the past 3 years, my income has gone down from 32 to 30 to 28,000 last year. I've worked more hours. I actually got a raise, but my buying power has decreased as well because I'm paying twice as much for gasoline. My insurance has gone up. My food costs have gone up. And even in the industry, copper prices have gone up. Aluminum has hit an all-time high. I mean, I do not see this as prosperity. I totally disagree with this professor. He needs to get out in the real world and talk to real people. The people who are building homes are borrowing money in order to pay these high prices. We're leveraging our prosperity on our future.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Mark?
Yeah. I appreciate the comment. I have been out. I have talked to lots of people. There are the aggregate numbers and there are the distributional effects, right? And it's important to think about, even when the U.S. economy is doing well, not everybody and not every sector of the economy is doing well. That is true in normal times and was true pre-pandemic. And there are a lot of distributional inequities. Some of those are urban versus rural. Some of those are one sector versus another sector. All of that is true, right? And there's enormous number of things that could be done to help individuals and to help households policy-wise that the U.S. government and the state government haven't done over many years, right? Prior to the pandemic, in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008. All of that is unquestionably true. And at the same time, as Rob, we were talking about earlier, the sort of compared to what question is to think about what the U.S. economy would have been like had we not had the economic policy response that we had, right? So the data that I've seen is that the average U.S. household received about $3,500 from the American Rescue Plan and the child tax credits and earned income tax credit, the set of policies we put in place in response to the pandemic economic crisis. And so in the absence of that, things would have been far worse, right? And it's true that households are spending more on food. It's true that households are spending more on utilities, they're spending more on gas when they go to the pump, et cetera. But if you net all of those things out for the average household, again, real income didn't decline, right, in the last year. And that's due to the policy response, right? And the policy response was deeply divisive politically. It was unpopular in large parts of the country, but it was unquestionably beneficial for the average household. And the U.S. economy has recovered, amongst the G7 industrialized economies. We are, I believe, the only economy that now actually has recovered and surpassed the 2020 levels. And so the policy response that we put in place relative to the UK, relative to EU countries, relative to Japan, et cetera, was much more aggressive and extensive. And it actually, insured American households and American individuals to a degree that other countries didn't, right? So again, as I was thinking about writing this, it's not that people haven't felt the pain of these crises, right? And it's not that everyone in the country has benefited. But in relative terms, right, both to China and Russia and relative to other countries we might compare ourselves to, the state of the U.S. economy is very, very strong. And the state of the economy relative to what it would have been absent the aggressive monetary and fiscal policy response is very, very good. Right. And again, I think that's absent from a lot of the media discussion, which is almost exclusively focused on inflation.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Tony joins us now in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I just disagree with this guy, and I'm going to tell you why, because he brings up averages. Well, me and LeBron James, if we average out our salary, we're making a lot of $1 million. But in the real world, I'm making about $50,000 a year, and LeBron James is making about $70 million a year. And the inflation doesn't bother him as much as it does me. But also at the same time, every time we have one of these recessions or something like that, it hits working class people harder and harder every single time. And the recoveries take longer and longer. Unemployment is not counted fully. Unemployment is only the people collecting unemployment, not people that are all on unemployment who stop looking for jobs or their skill sets do not meet new jobs because of lack of training resources.
Tony, I got you. We don't have too much time left. You gave us a lot to work with there. Mark, first of all, are we taking into account the inequity between Tony and LeBron James, for example, when we factor out the overall economy?
We are in the data. I mean, there, you know, the difference between the average and the median, which is the middle person, we are capturing that. But on the point about how we measure unemployment, you know, there's lots of different ways. You can look at labor force participation. You can look at real wages. You can look at the unemployment rate. You can look at unemployment by sector. Across all of these dimensions, we have returned to the levels that we were at prior to February 2020 and the onset of the pandemic, right? So again, as I said with the previous callers, the point is not to say that everything is equal and fair and that everyone in the economy is doing well. But, you know, the state of the economy relative to where we were 2 years ago, we had something that was as serious as the Great Depression, is as serious as the global financial crisis. And the economy on average and for most Americans has recovered, right? And that doesn't mean that it's better for everybody. And it doesn't mean that obviously LeBron James is not bothered by inflation when he goes to the pump in the way that the caller was or I am or you are. But, you know, for most Americans, the situation of the economy now relative to what it was and the state of the economy relative to what we hear about how awful everything is, and this is the worst things have been in 40 years, I think there's a very large disconnect.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That's Mark Hoplovich, professor in the Political Science Department and the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about his piece on American prosperity. You can find the link to that Journal Sentinel piece at wpr.org/centraltime. Also, Mark is going to chair a related forum that's coming up on May 4th for the La Follette School. It's called American Power, Prosperity, and Democracy. That'll be live at Monona Terrace in Madison with a virtual option as well. Today's school board elections will shape local education policy for the next several years. The results will have the most impact on a group of people who mostly don't have a say at the ballot box, students. But as Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin students are finding other ways to make their voices heard.
Allie Schlicht is a junior at La Crosse Central High School, where she's on the debate team. She's also part of a group of students in La Crosse who are working to connect the candidates in the local school board race to the students they'd be making decisions for.
That's probably always a concern of students, is a lot of times they just don't feel heard by adults. So that is something that I am looking for in a school board candidate, is somebody who would listen to students.
Allie and other students with the youth advocacy group Leaders Igniting Transformation organized forums for the school board candidates, where they asked about some of the issues they most want to see addressed.
According to the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction data from the 2018...
At a forum in March, Kaylin Adams noted that Black students are disproportionately likely to be suspended in La Crosse schools.
As a school board member, how would you go about reducing racial disparities and school discipline?
Kaylin got involved with lobbying the school board after going to racial justice protests in the summer of 2020 sparked her interest in political action.
The only thing we could really do is just say what we need to say, and then hope that it gets taken into consideration.
With the voting age at 18 and up, typically only seniors, and not even all of them, can vote for school board members. Allie says a board that answers more to students would probably look a little different.
I think a lot of the candidates would be focusing their campaign more on reaching the students and really seeing what they wanted more. Most likely also would be focusing their campaign strategies towards addressing the problems that students feel the most concerned about.
For the La Crosse students, one of those problems is mental health. They even successfully lobbied their board to put $100,000 of the school's federal relief funds toward mental health services. They also say addressing racial disparities and reducing the district's carbon footprint should be priorities. Some Wisconsin school boards have given students a literal seat at the table, if not a vote. Menominee Falls, Sun Prairie, Howard Suamico, and other districts have two non-voting student seats on their board. Bayport junior Kara Reen joined the Howard Suamico board in spring 2021, a contentious time when the state mask mandate had just been overturned and school boards were scrambling for next steps.
It was just very, very fiery school meetings for around since I joined. So being part of that, I think, just gives me more awareness about what's going on in my community.
She says all the uproar can be frustrating. Kara would like to see the board be able to focus on issues the student body cares about, like support and funding for social-emotional learning or equity and educational access, especially in areas like math and technology.
Really, this is about students from elementary to high school and being ready for the future. As a student, I just don't want the board to constantly have petty fights over things that really aren't about students or school board issues.
Rohan Gala is a Bayport senior and the other student board member. He says national arguments over race and library books and LGBTQ issues have been overtaking board meetings in Wisconsin. That's created what he calls a heightened tension around school board meetings.
Parents and the community members now see the importance of school board meetings and the things that school boards talk about. And so while I would like to see a lessening of tensions within the school board, I also don't think that that could happen.
In the meantime, Kara, Ali, and Kaylin say they've seen more of their fellow students interested in this year's school board elections than ever before. The students say they may not stay engaged with these school boards forever, especially if they move away for college or work. But it has made them passionate about political engagement and how they can make their voices heard. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.